Hey everyone, welcome to the Developmentor podcast. I'm your host, Grant Ingersoll. As always, I'm focused on helping our listeners explore all the different career paths in technology, ranging from engineering to investing, from technical writing to technical leadership. Today's guest, I'm pretty sure, falls into all of those categories. Having worked in tech for a number of years, she's worked her way up from an engineer through to a CTO, VP of engineering. She's also written books, and I'm pretty sure she actually has done some investment as well. So great to have on the show, Camille Fournier. Camille, welcome.
Thanks. I'm very happy to be here.
Great. So I've given a little bit of a teaser on your background, but why don't we just start off with you giving us the lay of the land in terms of your background, your career, maybe your education, all of those good things.
Sure. So I have perhaps one of the more traditional backgrounds for coming into tech that you might feature on this show. I had a computer science degree. I went to Carnegie Mellon for my undergraduate degree. I also actually have a master's degree in computer science from the University of Wisconsin. So I studied CS. My first job was at Microsoft, and I worked on the common language runtime for .NET. This will show my age to those who are familiar with it. I worked on the Itanium port of that. So that was an interesting project. And then I went to graduate school, so that was in between undergrad and graduate school. And then after graduate school, I actually went to work at Goldman Sachs. And at Goldman, I worked in a bunch of different roles. Goldman was sort of an interesting transition for me because after graduate school, I was actually not sure I wanted to stay in tech. I had these great degrees and I had worked a lot of internships and I'd worked at Microsoft and I had intended on going to graduate school to get a PhD. And I just felt like, I just didn't quite fit in tech. I was really, I was struggling with what is my job actually going to be like? Am I really going to enjoy this? Like, I felt like I was still good at tech. I was, a decent, systems thinker and programmer and whatever, but I hadn't really felt like I had found the kind of success I expected up to that point. And so when I moved to New York to work for Goldman, I actually took that job because I wanted to live in New York City and not because of much of anything about Goldman Sachs in particular. Like the job that I worked in, the team I was working in, the people seemed nice and it seemed like it could be interesting. But, I kind of had pivoted away from optimizing for like the hardest core tech job that I could find in favor of like, well, I want to live in New York and I don't really know what I want to do with my life anymore. So let's just take this job that pays me well enough to live in New York and we'll see how it goes. And that actually worked out really, really well for me. That's actually a piece of advice that I give to a lot of young people is that it's easy to have this idea of what you should do based on your background, based on what people around you say is cool. I mean, a lot of people from Stanford and a lot of people from Stanford think that they absolutely should start a company. That like, that is the only, really like legitimate career path is to be a founder. And the reality is like most people will not be successful founders, would not enjoy that job. It's a very hard thing to do. And, for me coming out of Carnegie Mellon, coming out of this master's degree, I felt like I should be doing like really low level systems programming. That was what I thought I was really interested in. And, so I took a job in Java, at an investment bank. And that saved tech for me. That saved my career in tech because it turns out that the team I was working on was working on risk analysis systems. And the problem was actually big. We had a lot of data that we wanted to allow the analysts to access and sort of do what I kind of refer to as like interactive data mining on really quickly. And we were pushing the limits of the JVM in terms of how much memory we were actually using in these systems. And so I was both working on really interesting technical problems, as well as working with nice people, working in a proto-agile environment. So this was kind of like the very early days of the agile movement before it had kind of been turned into what it is now, which is sort of like a lot of consultants and process and dogma. It was much more just like, hey, we write tests for our code. We like partner together to write code sometimes. We do this pair programming thing, not all the time, but sometimes. And we actually release our code frequently, which was the thing that I discovered I was really missing when I was working at Microsoft. I was working at Microsoft on a project that like was part of like a multi-year initiative that, you know, your code isn't really seeing like the light of day for years and years and years. And whereas I come into this environment and all of a sudden, like, we're releasing this code to our end users every 2 weeks, which was at the time really, really fast. Wow. And so that kind of turned me around in tech, because it turns out that, like, actually I am a good programmer and I am a good, you know, engineer, and being able to see the fruits of my labor quickly and iteratively meant that I learned really quickly and I was able to like get a lot done. I learned a lot about distributed systems in the process, because part of the work that we had to do was actually take this giant, you know, single node thing that we had created and turn it into a distributed system, essentially a bespoke distributed system. And so I did that for a number of years. I worked on that. I worked on the Apache Zookeeper project as part of another thing that I did at Goldman Sachs. And I kind of like really spent a while becoming a really solid engineer. And, you know, I was a tech lead and I did a tiny bit of management there. But I kind of hit this point about 6.5 years in at Goldman, where I realized that there was kind of a limit to my ability to have impact given the size of the company and the kinds of roles I was in. And I wanted to do something completely different. So I decided that I was going to leave my very stable big company job and go find a startup. Because this was kind of, you know, 2010, 2011, when the startup scene was sort of coming back after one of its many sort of die downs. And there, you know, a bunch of my friends had started like leaving companies like Google to work at startups. And there was stuff going on. There's stuff going on in New York City that you could do. I didn't have to like move to California to do this.
Yeah.
So I decided that I both wanted to go do a startup and experience what that life was like. And also that I wanted to see if I could maybe, you know, get into more of a leadership role, become, you know, at the time, sort of management and leadership were kind of co-joined in my mind, but, you know, get in a role where I was, you know, managing some people and leading some stuff. And so I took a job at a company called Rent the Runway, which is a women's fashion company that rents designer dresses and accessories. And that turned out to be one of the hardest things I ever did in my career, but also by far the best thing I ever did for my career. Because, you know, I joined them as a director of engineering and ended up basically very quickly getting promoted to be the head of architecture and then VP of engineering, SVP of engineering, and CTO. And so, you know, kind of got the chance to join this team that was early stage, but not like super, super early stage, and grow it from, you know, around 15 people to about 65 when I left. And that really just taught me so much about leadership and management and, you know, working at startups and creating cultures and all of that. So this is a long career background. Yeah. So that's kind of how I ended up in, you know, leadership management circles. When I left that job, I intentionally said, all right, I'm going to reset. I don't know what I want to do next. You know, I was exhausted, frankly, from working at a startup for 4 years, because startups are exhausting. And I didn't want to just like jump into a new job immediately. I had the ability to take some time off. So I ended up taking off about a year and a half, and I spent a lot of time doing a bunch of different things, but most importantly, I wrote the book, The Manager's Path, about the things that I learned working at Rent the Runway and sort of helping people get a sense for what the progression through various stages of management might look like. I also, you know, frankly, I tried to do my own startup a couple of times and never really got any traction with any, just couldn't quite get through to like an idea that I felt passionate about. Long story short, at the end of all of that, I am now the head of platform engineering at a financial company called Two Sigma, which is a hedge fund here in New York City. And I am actually really enjoying it. So I'm getting to do kind of the two sides of things that I'm really good at, which is managing a very large team and being a leader of engineering at this company, but also working in, you know, building out platform, distributed systems, infrastructure, which is something that I spent a lot of time in my technical side of my career working on.
Wow. That's wow. there's so many things in there to delve into. I think, I guess I had it right in the fact that you've done the engineering role, you've done the tech lead role, you've done not just engineering leadership, but actually executive leadership. You've written books. And all throughout it, I get the sense too that there's this constant desire to stay technical. And I want to come back to the book here a little bit, but one of the things in the book that struck me as I was reading it is you emphasize this notion of technical management. And I think when people hear, oh, I'm going to be an engineering manager, all they hear is the manager part. And you kind of go out of your way to emphasize that you still need to be technical. So how does that work for you? Like, what do you do? What are some of your habits that help you both manage people and be technical?
I mean, it's hard. I think the first thing is I spent a long time being technical before I ever went into management. You know, I really emphasize staying technical until you feel extremely confident in your technical instincts and technical abilities is important. And that takes time. Like I kind of liken it to, you know, achieving mastery, which for most people, you know, 10,000 hours is like kind of the Malcolm Gladwell saying about mastery, you know, 10 years. It depends on the person, but I think most people, if you're assuming you get some kind of training, some kind of a degree or, you know, whatever, you spend some number of years kind of training and then you actually go into the workforce, you know, you're probably talking a good 5 at least years just sort of writing code, building systems, building larger and larger systems, or, you know, experiencing different types of software development before you've really like gotten that mastery of something. And it doesn't mean you're going to be the master of everything by any stretch of the imagination, but like really getting a lot of depth in something, whether it's like, you know, JavaScript front-end engineering, or in my case, you know, a big distributed systems engineering, or, you know, whether it's like databases is your area of mastery. You know, there's a lot of different areas of mastery. It could be mobile engineering, iOS engineering, right? But I think like having that technical baseline is good, because once you really go into management, as certainly at the level I'm at, and even like a couple of levels before that, you are not hands-on. You're probably not doing your job if you're spending any significant period of time writing code in your job. When you're managing, just like you get to a certain point of management and it just doesn't make any sense for you to be writing code as part of your job. And frankly, like writing code outside of your job can be fun. And some people really like doing that. And I think if you enjoy doing that, that's great. But I think, especially again, for people like myself, where we're talking about people that are really building big production systems, there is such a huge difference between, I played around with like Docker and Kubernetes by myself and like spun up a little cluster and it was cool, versus what you actually learn when you do that at scale, putting this stuff into production, that you can almost get the wrong instincts if you rely on the fact that you're still like playing with these little systems to be able to guide your technical judgment. And so I really think like just setting a strong baseline is much more important than continuing to write code well into your management career. But I think the other thing that you do to stay technical is just continue to like read and talk to people. A lot of the ways that I continue to stay technical is I have a lot of friends who are very technical, who are still very hands-on. And I spend a lot of time just like listening to them talk about the challenges of their jobs. I spend a lot of time, you know, reading blog posts, listening to talks, you're kind of immersing yourself in the world of what are people thinking about on the technical side? What are they talking about? What are they learning? That also that helps a lot in keeping your instincts there, in keeping sort of your knowledge fresh, right? So if you've got the instincts built over a career, you keep your knowledge fresh with new stuff coming in. I think that's a good mix for technical managers.
Yeah, and I find too, like, this is something I know I've struggled with in my career, right? And I think I have a pretty traditional path like you of doing the CS degree and the master's and letting go of those commit rights, if you will, of being able to change the code is one thing. But then a friend of mine said it to me really nice. He's like, Grant, do you want to see your ideas implemented or do you want to just be able to work on a single idea, right? Like you get to have this multiplier effect when you move into management, right? That you can now start to coordinate across people and actually see, potentially anyways, ideas come to fruition faster or more complete than what you could ever do on your own.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, you know, also like you get to kind of nudge the direction of so many ideas. And that multiplier, that sort of leverage effect is much easier to have as a manager than it is as an individual contributor. So, you know, I think, for at least people like myself, that was definitely a big pull into management. Was I wanted to be able to make more bigger things happen than I was ever going to be able to make happen by myself.
Yeah. And let's talk a little bit more about the manager's path. So you wrote this book. I mean, go in a little bit deeper. Who's the audience? Who listening to the show should pick it up? Like, what's the target audience? What does somebody learn? Like, what are some of the key takeaways from the book there?
So the target audience was people sort of in the early stages of their engineering management career, or people who were curious about engineering management. The most shocking thing about this book that I have found is how many people recommend it to people who are very early in their engineering career in general, who have absolutely no intention of going into management. So it seems to have struck a chord beyond its intended audience.
Great.
And I think the reason for that is that it is actually helpful for everyone to have the ability to understand what the job of management is sort of like, even if you're not a manager. Like I think that it helps people understand, like, oh yes, this is the things that my manager is probably worrying about right now. And so what helps them communicate better their ideas to their manager and therefore kind of be more successful in their career. So that has been sort of a surprising side of this book. But it was definitely written with managers in mind. It was written to help people who are thinking about management, curious about, you know, getting on the management track, the manager's path, as it were, what the different stages of that might look like, and actually like answer really tangible questions about, okay, I'm doing this thing. My team is not operating as well as I think it should. What are some things I can do to figure out how to make them more effective? Like, what are some things I should be looking at? What are some processes I might put in place? So I really wanted it to be also a very pragmatic resource for managers who were actually like having issues, that having problems that they needed to solve. They needed ideas for how to approach. Because I just didn't see anything like that out in the market at that time. There didn't seem to be really any books that were really pragmatic. There's plenty of leadership books at a very high level, but very little that was really about the day-to-day work, particularly for engineering managers, where I think that technical side of the management is, you know, is something that you need specific resources for engineering and not just sort of generic being a good manager resources.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, because I think a lot of times the engineering manager is just the person who was the best engineer at that company. You see this a lot, I think, in startups as well, right? That's not necessarily the case. Or maybe the manager is the person who had the, you know, was the most people oriented in their job as an engineer. And yet, so few companies, I know I've circulated within our company, my current company, and same kind of feedback of like, there's no guide for this, right? Because you've got to be able to go back and forth, and you've got to first be managed, right? But then you need like a playbook on how to do it. And it's not always obvious, because you're dealing with very complex problems that need to be solved. And just trying to figure that out can be really hard to dig into. And in fact, I think one of the things that I really, one section in particular in the book that really struck with me is you have kind of in the tech lead to manager transition, you talk a lot about the imagined life of a contributor and the imagined life of a manager, right? Can you go into that a little bit more? Because I think, you know, especially for people who are listening to this and they're like, okay, I'm an engineer now, but maybe I want to be a manager. Perhaps, you know, dispel some of the myths, if you will, and give some more insight as to why somebody would want to make that leap.
Yeah, so that was that section was actually one of the hardest parts of the book to write, because I wanted to be fair to both sides without sugarcoating it. So, you know, in the imagined life of a manager side, a lot of people, I think, do imagine that as a manager, you get to tell people what to do. And really, that is, in general, not true. Certainly, most people, first of all, like managing engineers, remember that we are in like an engineering job crunch. There are more jobs for engineers right now than there are engineers. So engineers you know, you have to kind of treat them nicely or they will quit. And as a manager, that's a big problem, right? When you're, when people on your team quit or don't want to work for you, that is, you know, very difficult. A lot of managers spend a lot of their time on recruiting, retaining talent, right? That's a big part of your job. So a lot of people, I think, imagine that, well, I have good ideas and, you know, I know the direction that we should be going with whatever we're doing, right? I know what we should be doing. Give me the management job and I will get to tell everyone what to do. And therefore they will do the right things. They will operate better. And I will admit that I had a little bit of that when I went into management. So a lot of people are like, oh, if somebody says that you should just never make them a manager because, you know, they're sort of going at it for the wrong reasons. Look, I will admit, as a person who felt some of that, I don't want to like say that you can never make someone a manager if that's part of their desire to go into management, but you have to realize that that's actually not what you get to do as a manager. You very occasionally can say no to something or very occasionally can sort of push things in a direction that you want it to go, but it's a lot more nudging and a lot more kind of, you know, trying to sell your ideas than you might expect as an individual contributor who's frustrated because you can't get things done because you can't sell your ideas. Right. Now, the flip side is that as a manager, you have a little bit more authority over what gets done, certainly not complete, you know, not telling people what to do, but you do have a little bit more authority over like, all right, how we're going to staff projects, how we're going to, you know, what we're going to invest in, but you have very little ownership of your own time. So there's your time belongs to other people. You have to be, if you work in a company that has an office, you have to be in the office. In fact, if you work in a company that has an HQ and you don't work in the HQ location, your career prospects at that company as a manager are probably somewhat limited. Not that you can't do things, but like, I mean, Google is famous for this, right? If you want to go beyond a certain level at Google, you're going to have to spend some time in Mountain View.
Yeah.
It's just really hard to go beyond a certain level where, you know, you're either on a plane all the time going out there or you've just moved there for a few years. So you, in some ways being a manager has more freedom, but in a lot of ways, like your time does not belong to you anymore. Whereas the opposite is true, I think, for individual contributors. Individual contributors have so much more ownership over their own time. That you know, you are really not going to be pulled into a million meetings, hopefully, if your company is well run. If your company is not well run, that's a different story, right? But you know, you may be pulled into meetings 20 or 30% of the time, whereas your manager is pulled into meetings 80 to 90% of their time, right? So it's a totally different trade-off. So you have a lot more freedom to do things, you know, that do kind of what you want to do, especially at the more senior levels. Individual contributors are often given a lot more freedom to pick kind of what they want to focus on. Now, the downside to that is that the career path growth is often is slower for individual contributors past a certain level. Management is almost like a numbers game, right? Depending on how many people you have, you need a certain number of managers. Depending on how many managers you have, you need a certain number of managers of managers, et cetera, et cetera. Yep. Whereas, you know, senior individual contributors, it's very different, right? Depending on the company and the complexity of the technology, you will need different numbers of, you know, staff or senior staff type level engineers. And, you know, some companies just don't need very many of those at all. Some companies need a lot of them, right? So it's, you know, partly about getting to the right company in building a career as an individual contributor, but it's also about like, it takes a lot of time because you're being judged really on your individual efforts for the most part. And that means that, you know, it just takes a lot longer to show results and show that you've placed good bets and therefore delivered a lot, the same level of value. So you know, those are kind of some of the trade-offs that I talk about there. And I really tried to be fair to both sides with that, or I think there are good and bad to both of those roles. And, you know, it's definitely not a, not a easy choice.
And I do think you were fair in there. And one of the things I loved in about it too is that, you know, hey, it's all right if you don't want to, you know, you could try it and then take a step back, right? Like if you find you don't like the management route, like that's not the end of the world. Plenty of, especially these days, technology-focused companies, right, have very viable career paths for technical people. In fact, I think
absolutely.
One of the earlier guests I have on the show, Drew Ferris, talked a lot about this. He's at a big consulting firm, and he's made very conscious decisions to stay technical as he's grown in his career there. So,
yeah, no, that's I think that's absolutely true. There is a path for individual contributors, and you know, if it doesn't exist at your company, you can find a company where it does.
Yeah, the roles like chief architect or architect roles, chief architect, and some companies even, and maybe this is a good transition to the next question, the CTO, depending on the company, can take on a variety of roles. It's interesting just reading about the way you've been a CTO and the way I've been one is like I've run engineering, but then I actually took a step back and said, you know what? I want to focus on technology and being outward facing with customers. Whereas you've gone the I'm going to run engineering and I'm going to be the CTO at the head of the engineering org. Whereas other CTOs, like you said in the book, it's kind of a nebulous term or a nebulously defined job, you know? So talk a little bit about like going up to that next layer above managers of managers, the VP of engineering, CTO type roles, or perhaps even your current one of head of platform engineering.
Yeah, I mean, it's very different and it depends on the company that you're at or what those jobs look like. But they tend to be, you know, at that level, you are an executive. I think whether it's even, you know, VP of engineering, CTO, and my role sort of head of platform. And so you really need to be able to think very broadly and strategically about the company and contribute, you know, whatever skills you happen to have, whatever ownership you have to have, contribute really at a company leadership level. That is a little bit different than when you are kind of a manager of manager and you're over a very specific function or sort of a smaller, yeah. You have a smaller scope. In a lot of ways, you know, I'm a woman who like, you know, I like to take in new data and change my mind about things as I get more data. You know, I'm a little bit softened on the executive who is a bad manager than I was, you know, 5 years ago. There are a lot of executive roles, CTO, VP of engineering, not so much, hopefully. But, you know, CTO and sort of VPs of various types of functions where the person who's the best person for that role may not be a great manager. They may be a really, you know, they may be an amazing strategist. As you said, like, you know, when you took the CTO role, you stepped back from managing the team and you really focused on external customers, right? They may be the person who is just amazing at being the face of the technology for this company. And frankly, like there is such a thing as executive presence. If you're selling to other CTOs or CIOs or, you know, executives at other companies, being able to, you know, meet them and have that kind of that executive presence and, you know, show that, yes, you are mature, you know, your company is a company to be trusted, you know, you're at their wavelength is actually pretty freaking important. That's about, you know, and that is not necessarily, again, the same skill that makes you really good at managing a team and then getting a key team to be really effective.
So true.
So I think there's different. I always tell people who say, you know, my career goal is really to be a CTO. I say, then go be a co-founder of a startup.
Right.
The easiest way to be a CTO is to co-found a startup. Period, end of story.
Yeah, be the technical co-founder, period, end of story. I like the way that's exactly right.
All right, like, you know, very few people are like myself who work their way up into a CTO position, even at startups. Yeah. It's just not that common to work your way up. I mean, people obviously do it at big companies. They absolutely do. But, you know, you're talking, you are committing to like years and years of building a reputation, you know, building a portfolio of strategic work, or, you know, building out to like a big enough role at a big company where a small company will say, you bring a bunch of cachet to us to hire you as our CTO. So that's what we're going to do. You know, if your number one career goal is to be a CTO, go co-found a company. Yeah. you may, you know, be careful what you wish for, but but that's the fastest way to do it because it just is otherwise, it is a very different job than what you're going to learn even growing as a manager at any kind of size company. So, you know, there is kind of a shift that not everybody will successfully be able to make if they just try to work their way up into it.
Right. Well, so let's then just two questions. Then I want to get on to talking a little bit about what you've got coming forward, how you see, you know, the future of these things. Explain a little bit about, you know, this title, Head of Platform Engineering.
Sure. So my current company is a very tech-focused hedge fund. And so the way that we have divided up engineering is across the sort of core areas of the business. So we have trading engineering, for example, is all about our, you know, the platforms that actually trade with the markets. And so I run platform engineering. And really what we own is all of the common systems, whether they're developed in-house or they're open source that we've customized or whatever, that all of the other areas of engineering use. So this is things actually includes like our developer tools, our SDLC tools. We have a gigantic Git-based mono repo, and there's a lot of bespoke work that goes into making a system like that work and scale. We have custom storage systems because, you know, finance is one of those areas where you can either spend a lot of money getting, you know, proprietary off-the-shelf storage, or if you have the right people on the ground, you can actually build. It's actually one of the cases where it does make sense to build your own storage systems. So we actually have proprietary storage systems. The teams that manage our compute infrastructure, so our Kubernetes infrastructure, as well as like our platform as a service work. We're kind of running all of those different kinds of systems and developing them, scaling them. You know, it's a mix of, you know, pure software development, integrating, working with open source, extending open source to work better in our environment, working with the cloud, you know, taking, you know, proprietary on-premise workloads, making them work in the cloud, obviously doing a lot of work with security because security is very important in finance. Yeah. So those are some of the many things that my organization does.
Wow. So somebody who wants to be in the mix of kind of all the moving parts would really love this role. You've got distributed systems, you've got storage, you've got engineering lifecycle all built in there. Somebody who wants to kind of be at the heart of all things engineering would really enjoy this type of role, which sounds like it's a perfect fit for you because once you realize going all the way back that yes, you did indeed love tech. It sounds like you found, in fact, that role that fits really nicely there. So, you know, just one final one, and this is perhaps a little shift on the career side of it, but you know, you've written this book, you actually talked about some of the surprising things about it. Talk a little bit about the actual process of being a technical author, right? You know, there's obviously a lot of careers in technology, and actually writing books can be a nice side thing for helping you make your career. So kind of take a step back and talk about, if you will, the meta side of the book.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I had this idea, well, I had been blogging for a while. So I do think that, like, if you're interested in becoming a technical author, start blogging. Yeah. Start writing now, right? Because the more you write, the better you get at writing. And, you know, that's a very valuable skill no matter what you do in tech. Even if you never want to write a book, being a good writer is really a valuable skill. And so I had been blogging for a while, and I decided actually to do this thing that happens every November called National Novel Writing Month. It's sort of this, like, weird thing that a lot of people do where they spend the month of November and the goal is to write like 3,000 to 5,000 words a day. And, you know, ultimately end up with, like, maybe it's 3,000 words a day to end up with like a 90,000 word manuscript. And I think it's, you know, focused on people who actually want to do creative writing. But I decided that, you know, the year that I left Rent the Runway, I was like, I'm just going to see if I can, like, you know, throw out 90,000 words on engineering management and what that would look like. And I did. And so that actually turned into sort of the draft, the very, very, very rough first draft of the book. So the thing about, I guess, writing, besides, like, if you think you want to do it, my definite advice is start blogging, is also, I am amazed at the number of people who do it while working a full-time job.
Yeah.
I don't think I could have, like, written a full book while doing a full-time job. There are, like, a lot of people co-write books with people, and I think, I'm sure that makes it very different. And I have friends who write technical books that are really about, like, you know, showing you how to use various technologies. And they've just gotten so good at it that they can just, like, crank it out while working and it's no big deal. And I'm like in awe of those people. But for me, it was a lot of creative work. It was on and off over months was the process of writing. But, you know, when I was writing on the days when I was really like writing a lot, you know, I would work for 3 or 4 hours maybe on writing stuff and editing stuff and thinking, and I would just be creatively done for the day. I would not have had any energy to do anything else. So, yeah. But you know, I do think if you're interested in writing, start writing, you know, start blogging, start writing talks is another good thing. So if you're interested in, you know, becoming a speaker as well, like speaking at meetups, because the thing you need to learn how to communicate is fairly similar in both cases, right? You just need to learn how to take a complex concept and teach it to people in some way. And, you know, that can be purely technical things. That can be things like I talk about, which is, you know, between technical and management. But that honing that communication, and that is a really useful skill for whatever you decide to do with your career, management, IC, data science, product manager, whatever. That is just a super valuable skill.
Yeah, the art of communication at the end of the day. I could tell you, like, that's one of the biggest factors I always tell, you know, people fresh out of school is like, you know, look, whatever you choose to do, make sure you can communicate it. And part of that's writing, part of that's speaking, part of that's training, et cetera. I'm chuckling throughout because I did the other way of writing a book, like you said, and it took me 5 years to get it done.
Yeah. Maybe that's the difference.
I like to say I was ahead of my time, but thankfully I procrastinated. One question, just shifting gears a little bit, you know, you've talked a lot about a lot of the good things in across your career. You know, what are some of the downsides or maybe some of the challenging aspects of these roles, just to kind of keep it real? Like you said, you've written this very pragmatic book. Bring that home for some of the challenges you've faced personally.
Working at startups is challenging.
Yeah.
And I think it's true whatever role you're in, but it is extremely challenging in an executive role just because you tend to be working with people under extreme pressure who don't really know what they're doing. You know, if you're lucky, you're working with people who maybe have started a company once before, but yeah. Most of the time, you know, just so much of the time you're working with people in some role or maybe all of the roles who this is their first time doing it. And it might also be your first time doing it as it was for me. Yeah. And so you're on the one hand, you learn a lot. If you can hold on to that, you know, rocket ship or whatever it is, you can hold on and keep up. You will learn a lot, but no opportunity where you learn and grow that fast comes without a price. You know, for me, I would say it was, you know, a lot of work. I was burned out by the end of it. And I was not like, I did not admit to myself, I think that I was burned out, but you know, I took a year and a half off of like full-time work. And I think looking back, I had to do that because I was so burned out and I really needed to have a time to reset and just not have all of the sort of stress, you know, the stress and trauma of just all the hard parts of that job really kind of making me, frankly, act not in the way that I really wanted to be able, that I really wanted to be acting as a leader or a manager. And, you know, I do think that like, you know, I guess other things that are real, like you are going to disappoint people. People are going to disappoint you in ways that, you know, it's hard. I say that anytime somebody that I really care about quits on me, whether I could have done anything or not to prevent it, I lose a night's sleep. And I'm a very good sleeper. So for me to lose a night's sleep is really traumatic, actually. Yeah. You know, but like I will just go over and over and over and over and over in my head, what am I going to do without this person? What could I have done? And it sucks. You know, it hurts. You just take so much emotional strength to do this job. And it takes a lot out of you.
Especially when you may have recruited and brought and hired that person, right?
Yeah. You know, you feel personal. And like, especially when, gosh, you know, I've had people send me like poison pen emails while I've been out on maternity leave, not this time, but, you know, about like all the things that they were quitting and here's all the things that I was doing wrong with the team. Bye. And it's like, oh my, please never do that to someone. But you know, like the person who wrote that had some points, But, you know, it's like you just have to take it. And, yeah. You know, a part of your job is just taking it and not reacting and not getting, you know, visibly angry and kind of just tamping down all of your emotional reactions. And sometimes you'll be better at it than other times. And it is hard, you know, there are some big downsides. It is stressful. It is definitely not like, you know, just easy growth, easy whatever, super fun. You're doing whatever you want. You know, these are stressful jobs.
Yeah, no, it's so true. So that we don't end on all the stress, you know, along the way, like what's been the most surprising part or the most serendipitous or the happiest or however you want to quantify kind of if you're summing up this career to date, you know, that you would want for somebody who wants to follow that role, right? What advice, what little moments or the like, however you want to quantify that.
Honestly, I feel like the most serendipitous part of for me is actually goes all the way back to like going to work for Goldman and you know, staying in tech.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm so grateful I didn't quit tech when it was hard. Mm. And I think that a lot of people in the early years of their career, it's hard. And you're young and like, you don't know, you're figuring out life also. Like, most people do not know what they want to do with their life before they're like, you know, 28, 29, 30. like, you know, some people may seem that way, but I promise you, having been that and managed a lot of people in those ages, like a lot of people don't know what they're doing, no matter how successful they are or how much they seem like they do. Yeah. But I'm really glad that I stuck it out. And I'm really glad that I got to work. The way that I stuck it out was working in a group that like aligned with the things that I actually am really good at, where I could learn a lot and work with people that were nice. Those are just, you know, like look for that job where you like the people that you're working with and you're learning and you're being challenged, but you know, not too much. That job is out there and it exists. Mm. And you do not have to like quit tech to find that job. And you know, this whole podcast that you're doing, right? Maybe that job is not software engineering. Maybe that job is product management, or maybe that job is data science, right? Yeah. It's going to be different for every different person. But I do personally think that like the tech industry, technology in general, it's everywhere. It is, you know, it is in every company, there are opportunities to be technical and to make a big difference in a company by virtue of technical skills. And that is really like perhaps the luckiest thing about my life is that I was interested in that as a kid and I followed that particular interest down this career path. And you know, I'm glad that I did.
Wow. I think that's just a great way to wrap up, Camille. I want to thank you for your time and thank you for joining us on the show. So much great advice in there. And as I said, we'll link up the book, The Manager's Path, in the show notes. Thank you again, Camille.
Thank you so much for having me.